I'm super honored today to speak to Norm Kurth, who has been a great influence on the Agile retrospective space. And as you know, as our listener, I'm in the Agile space for a long, long time. And actually, I did get Norm's book at some point of time, and it has been on my bookshelf for a very, very long time. And I actually, I must admit, I think I skim read it when I bought it, as I did with a lot of books. But before we had this interview today, I did read a little bit again in it. And I had to admit that I just recognized that the prime directive, which all of us Scrum Masters and Agile coaches and facilitators know and know by heart, has been an influence Norm brought to the community. So I'm super honored to have a conversation with you, Norm, today, and I'm glad to have you.
Now, I want to comment on skimming my book. I put cartoons in my book throughout. How can anybody just pick up that book and not at least skip over and go from cartoon to cartoon? Oh my gosh.
That's actually what I've been doing, I think. I think Diana Larson recommended your book, or I heard your name in some of the retrospective facilitator gatherings 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And actually, I did read the cartoons and I found some of them funny. That has been a great thing to add to some points in your book, basically, to have some great cartoons in it. And I highly appreciate that.
Well, and I think it's good advice to authors who are thinking about writing dry technical books that clearly came from an outline. Spice it up with some cartoons or stories about or fables or whatever. Anyway, but yeah. and yes, the prime directive came from me. The prime directive, which is basically we assume and acknowledge everybody was doing the best job they could given their skills, ability, knowledge at the time, and the whole purpose of that is so that when we sit down and start talking about people's past work, blame does not come into the picture. Everybody makes mistakes. We make mistakes. Let's see what we can learn from them.
Yeah. And I'd love to have a conversation on the prime directive just right from the start, because I've taught it to a lot of people as an opening also for a retrospective to have that kind of frame. And I try to incorporate it more and more myself. And what I've recognized is that some people really get into resistance to that statement. And if you do that statement, use it over the top, you could also say, the person that just dropped a hot mug of tea on your trousers did just do their best, and that has been under the circumstances, maybe that person being a bit of tired that day and then something happened, and this didn't happen as something which you can't blame for. Is that true in that case? Or a person, I don't know, ruined my MacBook or something? Is that true? The person didn't do that? That maybe this person, there had been some, and there are mean people in that world, aren't there? So how does it relate? Because I sometimes have people who have a hard time to actually get in that state of mind of that statement.
Well, it is a very complex, it's easy to say, but it's very complex to really take in and parse, if you like. So the person who spilled coffee on your jeans did not intend to spill coffee in the jeans. And if they did, that's another topic that we can go down. But if it's an accident, it's an accident. Whatever they were doing, they did not intend to. So how can you get mad at them? You can get mad at fate. You can get mad at the cleaning bill. But, you know, if they did not intend, they did not intend. Mm-hmm. If they did intend, well, they also doing the best job they could to get your attention in some way or another. I debate this back and forth, because the real question you could ask is, did Hitler do the best job he could? Well, we do not want Hitler or any of the modern day oligarchs or authoritarian people doing what they're doing. But from their worldview, they are doing the best job they can to achieve their particular goals. You do not need to like what they are doing, but you have to acknowledge that they are trying the best to achieve whatever it is they're trying to achieve. And that's what the prime directive is. So we come together and we would talk about what's happened, without getting into the blame of an authoritarian doing the best job they could to, you know, mass power and take over world or whatever it is. Mm. But it is not about blaming them. Mm. It's deeper than that.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. And I think that's also the difficulty about that, to basically that it still allows to be totally unsatisfied or totally not in line with what happened, but that you don't have the discussion about this blame thing. And I think particularly in German, playing the blame game is something which is happening very, very often in companies and organizations and politics. Often if a politician is saying, I take the responsibility for that, stepping out of his job or leaving the office, taking responsibility is the same as I take the blame, and this whole blame game is just on another level. So, yes, and I think it's difficult to get into that state for some people to actually accept that this is the only thing which could have happened given the circumstances and the knowledge and the stuff. Right. Yeah,
yeah. I guess that phrase, if it's the only thing that could have happened, is really hard for people to accept. But, you know, I've been around your family for the last handful of days, and I see how you and your wife are with your children.
Yes.
And your children are great.
Thank you.
If parents approach interacting with their children always believing those kids are doing the best job they can, even though they are not doing what you want or ignoring you or annoying you or whatever it is, they're doing the best job they can at being a kid or training a dog. Dogs are always doing the best job they can. And sometimes you may need more training, but that's, and it's an attitude. You know, I grew up with that in my family. You can grow up in other ways, and maybe you can do retrospectives in other ways, but I don't think you can get a community together to really talk about what's happened honestly without first knowing that everybody believes you did the best job you could. And that brings us back to the power of retrospectives.
Yeah, totally. And I love the frame which is Prime Directive spans for a retrospective. What I needed to learn as a coach is sometimes that people need to vent, and that venting kind of includes sometimes giving someone blame, but at some point of time, venting has to stop, and we need to get in that frame of, okay, I can be dissatisfied with the result, but let's take and stop that blame game here, because it does not help anyone. Maybe your psyche as a person trying to cope with your frustration, but actually you can have maybe other places to do than to use that as retrospective. That can also be walk through the park with me as a coach, basically to vent, and it does not have to happen that much in a retrospective. So I'm a bit torn inside of me, like how much venting is needed for us to stay healthy. And sometimes projecting our blame to others is our means to protect our self-concept. And then bringing into the more productive way in what can we do with the situation? How can we change the situation, actually? How can we have systemic changes in that whole setup so that we don't have to talk about why Peter messed it up, so that we can talk about that we're unsatisfied with what came out of the situation? How can we change the situation in that way or as a system that it does not happen the next time?
Yeah, you know, venting is necessary. It's and is good. You can vent. You can vent about the situation. You can vent about how it impacted you without ever bringing Peter into the game. You don't even know if Peter is the real cause. Mm. Until you hear Peter's story, you do not know that he was involved with it. I don't even want to say it was his fault, because he was doing the best job he could, whatever it was. So let's just talk about you and the impact on you, and leave Peter on the side so that later he can tell his piece of the story. Okay. There was a retrospective that I ran where there was a manager and a bunch of people, and for a while everything was going on well. And then the manager started to become distant. He was never around. And when he came back, he suddenly was a micromanager, and he was really panicked about certain things that were going on. And no one liked it. So during the retrospective, people started talking about that period and how it impacted them when they were suddenly under this, you know, time pressure and micromanaging and distant manager and so forth. Finally, the manager got to talk about his piece of the story, which was outside of the group's awareness, the management wanted to cancel the project. They had run out of funds. And what he was doing when he was not around the team was he was finding other places to get funding to keep his project alive. And he was making deals that if you give us money, we will get this piece of this feature working by such and such a date so that we can keep the funding coming. And when you start hearing that, then you hear the whole piece of the story, not just how it impacted you and why you should be upset with your manager. After the fact, they asked, well, why didn't you tell us? And he said, well, if I started telling you the project's about ready to get canceled, you're not going to work hard on the project. You're going to start dusting off your resume. Hmm. And so he was doing what was right for the project. He was doing what was right for the team. Hmm. And he was taking the whole burden of this thing possibly canceling. Hmm. After discussing it, they said, yeah, okay, we understand. You probably don't want to tell us that we're about ready to get started, but maybe you could have shared that with your two project leads so they understood how important it was to get this next feature done by Friday. Hmm. So there was a lesson that learned out of it, and blame would absolutely not be appropriate, and the manager was doing the right thing. So you need to tell the whole story. No one knows the whole story until you have a retrospective.
Yes, and that often needs different perspectives in the same room, right? This is something, a moment where everyone speaks their highest truth in the room. There's something emerging out of that which is deeply connecting and which is just helps to make sense. That's what I've been feeling. And I also remember a comic in your book where I think it's mom and dad and they both have their perspective. And then I think the son is saying, you need to talk, right? And because they have so different angles on the same thing and they just need that kind of room for connection. I think that's a lot of what retrospective is about, right? It's a ritual to bring all perspectives in the room and make a sense out of that, right?
Yeah, it's bringing a community together to collectively tell the story. And the reason you're doing that is so you collectively can discover what the wisdom is. Wisdom is the learning that comes from experience. It's the earliest form of learning in our species, and it's very, very important, and it has been for a very, very long time. Retrospectives is not new. It's a very, very old ritual.
Yes, yes. And I particularly love the feeling of having a retrospective. Also, if you sit in a circle setting, it has some ancient old, that's the way we've always been sitting around a fire. And if you then have a speech token, something like comparable to a talking stick, and then you have this kind of attention on each single person, giving them room to basically state their perspective, there's some magic happening, which I can't explain. It's so much older than we all are, right? And you kind of helped us get that as a ritual in the software development space. And I think that is something which is particularly valuable there to have. And I guess it's valuable everywhere in each industry. But I've seen it most of the time in the computer science world, where people are a lot isolated in a specific way, sometimes because they have some specific way of seeing the world, right? You have a little bit more of Asperger and specific autism levels in the IT industry, where people tend to be a bit more on their own. And even if I look at myself, I'm a computer scientist, I can easily live in a lone cave for a long time, I think, and be happy with that. Actually, I needed to learn human interaction and learn to appreciate human interactions maybe more than others. And I think this is why retrospective have been particularly helpful in the IT industry. So how did that happen, that this kind of your influence and your learnings about retrospectives basically came to the agile space? What's the perspective you have on that, and what things you've heard about that?
When I wrote my book, the only way software was, or the smart way software was built was through the waterfall model. You know, you figure out what you're going to build in detail, then you figure out how you're going to build it, and then you get to start coding. As my book was coming out, the Agile Manifesto was signed off, was written, developed, and so forth. And in the earliest version of it, there was no discussion about retrospectives. Kent Beck and Ward Cunningham and I had all worked at Tektronix together, so we knew each other very, very well, and we knew each other's work. When Kent finally discovered what my book was all about, he immediately said, "Dang, we missed that. We've got to add that to the manifesto." So you'll find that if you go back at the history of the manifesto, it got slipped in after the fact. So that's how it got tied in, is that Kent Beck recognized the damn good idea. Mm-hmm. Oh, I just gave myself a crap. I'm sorry about that.
So I heard a keynote here at the RFG 2 days ago, and one thing which I found very interesting, that you had a really early experience in your life, basically connecting you with retrospectives, and also a kind of a sad occasion on which that happened. So maybe you want to share some of the things which happened to you, basically, and where you had your first real experience with the power of retrospectives, and when they are needed most.
My very first retrospective that I attended, I was probably 17. At that period of time, I was very seriously racing sailboats and quite good at it. And this was on the San Francisco Bay, which sometimes can get very, very heavy weather, which if you're a 17-year-old boy is cool, you know, putting yourself against the wind. During a race, one of my colleagues flipped his boat. And we have crash boats, motor boats around to help people get back up. But a lot of boats went over at that point in time, and nobody really noticed what had happened to him, which was he lost complete touch with his boat. Sometimes you can hang on to a rope or some other piece of the boat. He lost complete touch with it, and the boat was able to sail downwind or blow downwind faster than he could swim. Mm. He died. Mm. He died of hypothermia, which is very sad and caused a lot of people to stop. And you know, I sort of lost interest in wanting to sail about that time. Well, three sailors of whom I have a great deal of respect and who have won world championships and that sort of thing came together and interviewed and talked with everyone involved with the race, including me and all of my competitors and so forth. And they were able to do it in such a way that there was no blame involved, but they came to understand all of the mistakes that led up to the possibility that this person died, Richard died. And I came away first feeling no blame, actually feeling better than the fact that, you know, maybe I'm going to give up the sport. And the lessons learned were so deep that today, every time I step on a boat, those lessons are with me. I am ready to believe them immediately. Mm. Now, that was my first retrospective. I'm going to take over this interview for a moment and tell you about the most important retrospective that I've ever done. I think it was 2001. Terrorists took over airplanes and they started flying into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and so forth. The whole world had to stop, and the whole world had various kinds of emotions. And of course, the people who had lost loved ones were in the center of all of this. It was possibly 4 weeks later, Uppsala, the big programming conference at the time, was scheduled to happen. And 2/3 of the people that had signed up for it did not come. I think we were able to fly to Uppsala probably 7 days before the conference. So I showed up and saw this meager number of people and listened to how all the people that had the courage to fly into Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay was right next to Sarasota, Florida, which is where the anthrax was being mailed to.
I remember.
To the various people in camps. So we knew there was something bad very close to us, you know. And it's possible that at that period of time, people could want to make a statement against the computer scientists of the world who are, you know, changing the world in ways they may not have wanted to. So we had a lot of things to think about. So I looked around. I was scheduled to teach a class on retrospectives. And I walked in and said, okay, we can do my regular class, or we can, if everybody agrees, we can have a retrospective on your experience of watching and participating as a viewer of the events that unfolded in around 9/11. And everyone agreed, okay, let's go there. And so we set out and we started talking about our collective experiences, though everybody was in their own home or their own city, but there was a collective experience of us experiencing and watching it. And, you know, one family talked about how his young daughter, who probably could not really understand what happened, turned to him and said, after looking at that picture of the blue sky and the towers crumbling, and she said, "Isn't that pretty?" And her dad said, "Don't you understand there are people?" And she said, "Yes, people are dying. But look at the sky. Isn't that pretty?" Mm. And what he took from that is, it's a tragedy. And let's look at where life is going to go in the future. So we had a number of people share their real life experiences. And at the end, everyone had shifted from this deep thing inside their stomach, and they were all afraid to be able to talk about it because they had not lost as much as the people who had lost their loved ones. Mm-hmm. But by creating a space where the community could tell the story, it was so healing that they transformed, and they were able to go out through the rest of the conference and be significant participants. So every time there's a disaster, I urge retrospective facilitators to go out and interact with the people who are part of the disaster, and get them to collectively come together, tell the story, and maybe from there figure out where are we going to go from here.
So I just had one realization. I was raised in a Catholic way, and if people die, you will normally gather for of course, for the funeral, and afterward there's this kind of coffee which is happening. And in some perspective, this is also some kind of a retrospective, because people will look back on this person's life and their connections, and then you will share in a setting which is which is nice. You have some cake, you have some, all important people come together, and then you share the stories and you find the good things in the connection, and it kind of helps you grieve, and it helps you create something out of that which is living longer than this person actually did. And it also helps you to kind of have a retrospective on their lives and connect people, right? I think this is something which kind of relates to what you're just telling. There's also some kind of retrospective happening in there, right?
It's exactly a retrospective. A retrospective can be run many different ways. Mm. And the whole purpose of a retrospective is to collectively tell the story and get the lessons learned and move on. I also want to point out that when you go to those, the prime directive is in place. Everything he did that you're going to talk about anyway was the best he could do.
Yes.
But it is absolutely a retrospective.
Yes, yes. So because you're mentioning, like, after a catastrophe, and sometimes a person dying too young or a person dear to your heart dying, it's also a catastrophe for yourself, right? And you have to deal with that. And then that's one mechanism of our society to actually do that. And having that facilitated by someone who is connected with their own heart and holding the space, I think this is a great gift we can give to the world in various occasions.
Yeah. And so if it works for something as deep as after somebody's passed away, why not after a project comes to an end, or after a particular period of time that was significant during a project?
Yeah, yeah. And one realization I had when I glimpsed into a book 12 years ago was, normal speaking about this kind of two or three day post-mortem things. And I, as an agilist, I have to do that every 2 weeks. So what is kind of, what can I take from that to actually have it in my practice as a Scrum Master? And there had been some confusion inside of me for a while, like how this relate in this 2 hour long closing activity with the only 2 hours I have to facilitate the whole thing. And there was some confusion, which was on my mind for a while, but I think that they work quite well with then Diana's book and basically taking all of your thinking and connection and getting it more a bit in a structure, which is what had been more applicable to me. But maybe from your perspective, am I right that you facilitated more retrospectives like multi-day events in your lifetime, or would you say like you just can't tell, there's have been so many occasions?
So yeah, my experience with retrospectives was before Agile became the way to develop software. So I truly know nothing about doing an Agile retrospective. Diana Larson and Esther Derby's books, I'm not sure how many the two authors or Diana with other authors have done, speak to how to deploy it on a very short-term basis. The reason I've picked 3 days is that I was bringing a group of people together at the end of a project who first had to sit down and start feeling that it was safe to talk about what had happened throughout the project. And then for us to go back and review all that happened during the project. You can't just sit down and say, okay, what did we learn? What do we want to do differently? And so forth, because you get the answers of what happened in just the last 2 weeks. If you're looking across an entire project, you have to go back and really retell that story. And as you mine that for gold, you start finding ideas and thoughts that you were not thinking about if you're just thinking about the last 2 weeks. But the last part of the 3 days is we brought a community together, we have a collective story of what happened, and now I challenge them to find the most important things that they want to change as they go forward. And in this particular, on all of my retrospectives, we would get the workers, the programmers, and everyone else involved to make proposals to managers of what they wanted to do differently. And while they're doing that, they're developing buy-in among themselves, and they've got energy, and they want to do it so bad that the manager better just go with the flow. He's not going to stop it. She's not going to stop it.
Yeah, I can totally relate. So what we often do is basically go for, I don't know, 2 week sprints and have those shorter retrospectives with help and team development. And then we'll fly everyone in, because nowadays we have a lot of remote teams, and then we'll be there for 2 or 3 days. And then basically there's a retrospective happening, which has some timeline activity, which creates the last year or so with as a sticky wall. And then you would see also the core attitude in this project, in the sense of are we more satisfied or are we more dissatisfied with this whole process in which we are in? What were the highlights? What were the lowlights? And then people can dot vote on the lowlights and the highlights, and we can speak a little bit more about that. And I'm totally with you that this often releases a lot of energy, which we can project in the future. So people are really hyped on getting the next improvement done. If the improvement becomes crystal clear in that room, then you can really have that energy and use it for 2, 3, 4 months, basically to have some great improvements in the project happening. So I think it's for me a combination of both of the best I can actually have happening in a project.
So here are my thoughts on that. If an agile coach, I think is the term you used, has the skills and really understands what's going on in a retrospective and read the book seriously, they can have a big, big impact. Mm. Unfortunately, I bet most Agile coaches or Scrum Masters and so forth have learned very little about a retrospective. And so it's just become a term or a buzzword or something you could check off. And that disheartens me, because the kind of retrospective that you described is powerful and makes significant changes. But
Yeah, I'm totally with you. If you as a listener are regularly listening to our podcast, you know already that we are deeply dissatisfied with the qualities a lot of Scrum Masters and Agile coaches have out there, and that they didn't do the work which needs to be done, also the inner work which needs to be done to be a profound facilitator. Because from our perspective, if you don't work on yourself enough, it's people are having a hard time to basically engage on a deeper level in a retrospective or a field you're holding. So there's a lot of need in doing some inner work to be able and to have a clear intention on how you work with people. Besides all this process stuff and methodologies and liberating structures and whatnot, you can learn to actually have a proper structure inside of your retrospectives. And I'm totally with you, yes. And I, as a young Scrum Master, 2006, 2007, starting out, my first retrospective sucked that much. I had been a coder for the time being, and I was great at building software, but I was not great at retrospectives. And I think the first retrospective for just this, what went good, what didn't went well, and yeah, so let's talk about that. And that's been it. And so I guess my first year of retrospective has been okay. I think it's also an art you can learn over time, which is deeply related to other things you do in life and who you become as a person, as a facilitator, which kind of influences the stuff you're doing in retrospectives, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. The good facilitators of retrospectives really have built multi-dimensions with inside the way they are in this world. I think that everybody who has not been through a great retrospective or is just starting to learn how to facilitate retrospectives should pair with somebody who's an expert and get coaching and do observation and watch how they do. When I first started this, Don Reifer was the person who mentored me. He was the manager of the Galileo project and the software and the space shuttle and so forth. So he really knew what he was doing. And so I watched him do a retrospective. We'd sit around all through the night talking about what I saw him do and what he was thinking about and how he changed things and so forth. And then we'd go out for the next day and so forth. So yeah, I think you can't learn a piano by just reading a book. You really need to sit down with a piano teacher if you want to get good. If you want to get good at retrospective facilitation, get a retrospective facilitator teacher, if you want to call it that, and learn what you can from them and watch them and build.
Yeah, and as you mentioned that, I guess that's what happened along the lines. I've never booked a formal retrospective training or so, but I've seen a lot of great facilitators work in very different contexts, right? It has been personal seminars, it has been business seminars, it has been just projects where people would act and I would in some way be inspired by those people and the results they could create, and then learn and ask and find out what is happening there. And one person which kind of influenced me some years ago was Arnold Mundell, who has been a physicist, and he had an interesting take on people in a facilitated setting, because he sees everyone there as a co-facilitator. So everyone joining your class or your course or your retrospective is a co-facilitator. And that had been a really interesting shift from my own perspective, because until then I would also always see people as I'm the facilitator and they are the people who are involved or taking part of the class, and this is something different. And as soon as I shifted my thinking that all those people are co-facilitators, I could much more work with their intent, with their questions, with the stuff they bring to the situation. And that helped a lot. And this was something which was very inspiring for me as an attitude and a way to facilitate stuff.
I think what you learned there was very, very key. When you get a bunch of retrospective facilitators together and they're going to try to do work, they don't have a facilitator for the facilitators. They have somebody they call a convener. And that person convenes, brings us all together, figures out how, you know, all of the external support, you know, and where the meeting is and what time. But all of us as facilitators decide what we're going to talk about, how we're going to talk about it, and we sort of self-organize. So I think, yes, I think the you're there to guide, add structure and support, and then get out of the way and let the community collectively tell the story mm-hmm. of what happened and figure out what they learned and where did they want to go from there.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing I took away from a conversation we had those days was high-stakes situations. That's, I think, some word you used. And we often do very intense work in our seminars where also sometimes some good tears will be a sign of people processing stuff. And what's your take on emotions in those processes and people processing thing? I think we already touched the field of some grief work happening after 9/11. So how do you see retrospectives as a place to actually help people process stuff?
Okay, so first off, as a facilitator, you need to get experience knowing how to handle situations that are full of deep emotions. For me, I built those experiences by volunteering at a local organization that provided support for children who had lost parents, and also by being part of a group of facilitators for people who had lost their pets down at the local pet hospital and so forth. So you have to become comfortable rather than afraid of people expressing emotions, and you need to learn a great deal about how to channel that to a positive direction. You absolutely do not run away from it and be afraid of it. If you don't have the skills to be able to confront it, you're not ready to go to that level. And you should find a facilitator who can help you and grow in that direction. Now, emotions themselves are part of the learning process. You would expect them for high level kinds of or high-risk kinds of retrospectives. But boy, make sure you have somebody who knows what they're doing. I spend a lot of time taking classes that marriage and family counselors would also have to take. And that's a good start. You've got to get the theory as well as the practice.
Mm. So with great power comes great responsibility, right? So
if you said it perfectly.
Yeah. So, yeah, and words have power and questions have power. And if you're the facilitator, you even have some status in the room, which enhances even more the power of the questions you bring in the room, right? And then you have to be aware of the consequences and still accept that it's not controllable, that the fantasy of that you can control everything which is happening is untrue, and that whatever happen will happen. And there's also some room for serendipity and for stuff which is just happening in that room, which needs to happen, and also embrace that, right? I think this is sometimes also really, really challenging, because some people have the fantasy that it's about, I need to control the situation in the room. And what I needed to learn is that there's some kind of, however you want to call it, higher entity, a group process happening, which is surrounding all of that that's happening, and whatever needs to happen is happening, right?
You cannot control the process. You can structure it, you can get it started, and then you have to react. For me to get good as a retrospective facilitator, I had to give up control. And the way I did that is I went off and joined a comedy improv community and took a lot of classes, where with improv, you cannot prepare ahead of time for what somebody might do on stage and turn to you, and you're supposed to react. So I learned a lot from some really cool people. Comedians are great to hang out with. They are fun. I mean, like, if they want to invite you out to go drink beer, do it. You know, they are fun people to be around. But they also are very good at being in the moment and just take whatever energy that comes to you, comes from them to you, and then react with whatever kinds of experiences you've been able to glean, and whatever this higher power that you were talking about, or this university wisdom. There are quite many times that I will get a sense of I should do something that I've never done before, but I should do it. And I always go with that sense, and it always turns out much better than I ever thought I imagined.
Yeah. And now as we're talking about it, I think a fear a lot of people have, if it becomes more emotional, is that they get triggered and that they basically, that's a wound inside of themselves that opens up during that session, and they can't act as they would love to do because their prefrontal cortex is offline for a while, right?
Sure.
So yeah, I think that's something to learn and to de-trigger. And something I particularly enjoy that I'm often facilitating with Jasmine in the room, and as we are a couple of agile coaches, this happens quite often, and we have this kind of small gesture that if Jasmine comes close to me while I'm facilitating and she lays her hand back on my shoulder, I know that she does not want to cuddle. She's saying basically to me, you're triggered, now step out of facilitation, I will take over, take some breath, and then you can join in some minutes later.
What a great tool for the two of you to have.
Yes.
And absolutely, that is a must if you're going to go into these high intense retrospectives. And if you don't have somebody, and Diana and I, when we work together, are very good at that. When I'm alone, I've worked very hard at recognizing when I have been triggered, and that is because I want to say something with force or energy, and I want to express my opinion rather than be a facilitator. And whenever I do that, the first thing I do is I step back and take a breath, and then as I exhale, I step back and say, "This is not about me. This is about their story, and maybe I need to take another breath or two, but I do not say anything until I've been able to remove my emotions of whatever triggered me and said, I will deal with that later, and I can come back." You will find that marriage and family counselors, when they go through their trainings, work on that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And what I also recognized is that if it's been a tough facilitation for me, like the next day after, I often need to replenish my system and basically to do some activities outside in nature and process all the stuff I've been in, because it has become some kind of part of me, and I really need my rituals to get it off my chest and then come back for the next facilitation, right?
Yes, absolutely. You need to have that time to be able to take care of yourself. You should not be sitting down to your desk and working on email or sending out invoices or anything like that. You really should, you know, go for a canoe ride or take your dog for a walk or take your kids to the amusement park or, you know, but yeah, reconnect with you being human in this world and put what that experience that you went through behind. And again, that's another thing that marriage and family counselors have to learn to do as they're going through their trainings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really inspiring. I think you shared already so many nuggets of gold that I would had for maybe a final story or some wishes you want to give to our audience.
You know, as I hang around this community now, I hear a lot of grief over what has happened to Agile. You know, it was on a high point. It's now fallen down to something that's chaos, and it doesn't feel good. You long for those days that had happened before. But the first thing you should do is step back and think about this as a process. It's in fact predictable. If you think about the story of Camelot, It's a story that is not just about the King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Every culture around the world over time has a story like Camelot, where a few people come together with a really great idea and it starts to work, and a few more people buy into that idea and they want to create it. And then more people start getting into it because it's cool. And so it starts to grow. And then some people say, look at all those people doing something that all the same direction. There's money to be made. Let's get in there and try to figure out how to make some money. And that always leads to a demise. And that's predictable. And that's what's happened with Agile. So now is the time to step back and think about what your lessons learned were, what worked well, what do you want to do differently next time, what still puzzles you. All of these are questions that happen during retrospectives, and start thinking about where you go next. And the reason I can say there is a next is not only do all cultures have the story of Camelot, but they also have the story of the flight of the phoenix. That is, out of the ashes, some new ideas coupled with what was great from the past blend together, and the phoenix flies out of the ashes and becomes a bird, becomes something completely different than what you had before, but is beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing. And I've seen this happening over the last days here at RFG already, that people are basically saying, okay, now we're here. And what is emerging out of that? What's happening with the different topics which are already out there, and how can that relate to our work and the stuff we've learned over the last decades? So it's a really interesting process of recreation, though I must say it's personally, it has a lot of grieving about Agile being the easy gold standard for a lot of companies in the IT industry, and now becoming more and more selectively chosen and needing some extra mile to go through to make that happen, because I've seen the great results which teams could reach, and it's been so inspiring for me that I'm really curious about what we'll create as an Agile community out of the ashes.
If you want to know what's going to happen next, I can't tell you, but I know where to look. And that is, look to the youngest people of the Agile community. They got in not when it was a really great idea, but when it was in its decay, where people were trying to figure out how to make money, and these young people were able to sit back and say, well, this is the way it is, but it's not necessarily that cool, and I can tell you what I would do differently. People your age, my age, we don't have that insight, but the young people do. And so listen to them and figure out what they think is cool. And they need you to help guide them, because they do not know how to organize a large movement that goes to some new direction. So it's a blending of these new ideas from young people and the people who've had the experience of how to grow a movement. And that's the future. I can't tell you any more than that. But that will happen.
I thank you so much, Norm, for this interview. It has been really a pleasure to deep dive into your way of thinking. And I think I also learned a ton about deeper facilitation, and to hear from your perspective was really, really valuable. So thanks so much for joining our podcast.
It's been fun. Thank you for asking.